Normalized, the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, it is the dark of the moon. It is the dark of the moon, which is when people gather in community, yes, to determine the course of culture. It's the dark of the moon before the Chinese New Year on February 1st, Year of the Tiger. And it reminds me, we're all reminded of everything we've ever done, of the practice called Yongmen Zhangjin at the Providence Zen Center, which means to leap like a tiger while sitting. And we go, okay, we want all of these things, all of these things. So just backstage before our splendid guest can join us, wonderful. So yes, let our craft be our craft navigating the underworld river. Max Dashu reminds us that craft means power from dedication. So I am navigating the grief river. A hugely great ally friend died on Monday, and my act of love for her was to find her home, her doggy a home, which I did. Another friend died unexpectedly on Wednesday, going, whoa, okay, as I was taking my cat back from the vet recommending euthanasia, and I go, whoa, oh, when you get into this current, it's not funny exactly, but it's like, whoa, more of this. And this morning, my board op kitty, Amun-Ra, died in the embrace of his loving pack with the doggies and his sister and everybody. So remember, Dorothy Barker would answer her phone going, what fresh hell is this, right? Humor. Humor is important, dark humor, as we navigate the underworld, so important. So I am grieving my cat, Amun-Ra Mau, as deeply as my two dear friends who died this week. And let us remember Abe Lincoln, with whom our guest has much in common, or something in common. Abe Lincoln said, I care not for any man's religion whose dog and cat are not the better for it. And grief, of course, is love, which opens portals to all. So, yes, community, what do we turn to? Hey there, community radio. So, Storycraft at Dark of Moon, we gather, yes, and we welcome our great ally, Baratunde Thurston, dedicated to humor, wisdom, and compassion in service to complex conversations. He's an Emmy-nominated host who has worked for The Onion, yay, irony, satire, produced for The Daily Show, ditto, advised the Obama White House, and wrote the New York Times bestseller, How to Be Black. I'm reading it. He's the creator and host of How to Citizen with Baratunde, excellent guest, which Apple named one of its favorite podcasts of 2020, and for which he received the Social Impact Award. I just so prefer the word influence to impact, but here we go. He's also a founding partner of the new media startup Puck. In 2019, he delivered what MSNBC's Brian Williams called one of the greatest TED Talks of all time. He's unique in his ability to integrate and synthesize themes of race, culture, politics, and technology to explain where our nation is and where we can take it. His website is Baratunde, Baratunde.com. Welcome, Baratunde.
Caroline, it is good to be here on the Visionary Activist Show. What's up, Berkeley? What's up, Yay Area? Hello, community media. Thank you for having me, and good day to you. My condolences on the loss of your friends and family this week.
Friends and family and animal allies and, yes, and everything. So,
yeah.
But again, you know, I turn to yourself. You know, again, I've been in Baratunde world. I've been in Baratunde world. I've listened to many podcasts.
Even in my
TED Talk, I've read the book. I lived at 16th and Newton Street. Right.
We have to pause on that one. Can we just pause on lived at 16th and Newton? So I grew up in Washington, D.C., 77 till 89. And then we moved to Maryland and then up to Boston for college. But Newton Street is my home. Mount Pleasant, Columbia Heights, that's my
Mount Pleasant. No, and when you were born, I was on Ingleside Terrace.
What? Yeah. Okay, neighbor. So you live at 16th and Newton.
Well, never mind. That was about to be indiscreet. But okay. Absolutely. But so I saw, you know, the whole crack thing come down, which destroyed manners. It did, because it was, when I first lived in Mount Pleasant, it was wild. I think I was the only white person, but it was great community. You didn't mug people on your block. There were rules, and everybody watched out for everybody else. And when crack came, you know, it was, because, and also getting mugged, you'd go, well, you have to take my wallet, but not my driver's license. You could negotiate, right? But when crack came, no, it was all the fabric dissolved, right? Is that?
Yeah.
That was part of your mother's experience?
Yeah, the violence was part of the experience that led us to move. I think, you know, as a kid, the drug dealing was a background sight and sound of the neighborhood, and it was the context. And some of the dealers were the older brothers of my friends. So it wasn't just like, it wasn't entirely strange, but where it started to get hectic in a bad way was the violence. And the traffic coming through of people who didn't live there to conduct, you know, shady business, police presence. We had helicopters at times. We had shootings. We had people getting beat really badly. And I didn't fully understand at the time, but now in my 40s, to be a parent in that environment, and I have a daughter and especially a son who is at risk in so many different ways, from being recruited into that life to being an incidental casualty to being mistaken by law enforcement, that's a lot of stress on the heart, you know, and on the mind and on the spirit. So yeah, we ended up leaving in 1990, I think, is when we actually moved to Tacoma Park. Not very far, but a world away.
No, I know it well. See, I'm speaking to you from just outside D.C.
Okay.
So I know Tacoma Park. I know all those things. I'm right near the river where we send blessings down to the city. But also you write with appropriate dark humor about, I'm not sure that's about your father being killed in a drug deal gone bad. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we do what we can.
Yes.
To survive what we must. And so part of what I can do is deploy humor to help survive some of what I had to do, which was keep living, you know, in the face of death and of loss and of sadness and of things well beyond my control. So you know, the way I wrote about my relationship with him was a very limited relationship. And I tried to find absurdity, you know, in his absence and in his exit. And I wrote that in How to Be Black in certain ways. Yeah.
Yeah, no, dangerous in a good way. Again, you know, the humor, because I in many of your podcasts, one November 5th, the day of the election. Okay, but you know, you speak about your own process of metabolizing, you know, appropriate rage and anger and depression and despair and just which is in different doses. Some certainly carry more than others, but we want to do, and then you're crafting, and that's where I have to mention you're a Virgo, because you sow language craft, and you also you said you so love editing and composing on the written word before you were an orator editing.
I recently went through I took myself on a retreat, and I live in Los Angeles now in Southern California. I live with my wife. I'm healthy, and we've been strapped together because of COVID so much. And so it was a big deal for me to go off and do something by myself for a weekend. But I had time to sit and time to be alone. And I was using that time to consider, who am I? Who do I want to be? What do I want to be doing with my time, with my resources next? And one of the things I came up with is that I'm a kind of processor that I pull in a lot of noise, a lot of information, a lot of lines of communication and code, and then I do something to it. You know, I try to transform it. I understand it, synthesize, make sense of it, and then I emit something clearer than that which came in. And so sometimes what I'm sucking in is like racism, you know, just a ton of racism and old extractive economic thinking and small-minded ideas of like who can be an American, and meager ideas of what success and economic prosperity is. And I stuff all that, and a lot of Twitter, and just a lot of Twitter. I suck in a lot of Twitter. And then I jumble that around through my history, through my mom's wisdom, through my experiences, and use words, often spoken, sometimes written, to try to communicate out something a bit clearer than what came in, and alchemize that, you know, turn that poison into something else. Yeah. But it does mean I ingest a lot of poison, you know? And it does mean I'm swimming in some tormented waters, and I'm ingesting things that aren't healthy. And so I've got to, you know, I'm also finding ways to create distance from some of that hazardous material that is a requirement of the work I've chosen to do.
Right. And I can't help myself. I just have to bring up a little bit about your astrological chart without imposing, just for fun, because you're speaking it so beautifully. Is that okay with you?
Yes, please. Let's go for it.
Oh, good. So you, like Carl Jung, have the Sun square Neptune going to resolve. What is real? What is this? What is actual? And we'll get to irony. But you just spoke it beautifully, because it's a super conductive nervous system that extends, inhales, edits, brings it back by your high standard Virgo, edits. I like this from here, but not that. Collages and then puts it out again. But you said this beautiful thing, which is it's you get a lot out of a little, and you get a lot, so you're getting a lot. And so at a certain point, what you just did is beautiful. You're full, going, whoa, time to pull back into the vast private realms to metabolize, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what your retreat was, yeah?
Yeah, recover, heal, and prepare. Yeah.
Oh, all of let me take notes. Wait, recover, heal, prepare. Yes. And can we speak about irony? I'm so in love with irony, and it's part of your craft, right?
Sure. Let's speak about it. What do you have to say about irony?
Well, the thing I my listeners know, but I like to say it over and over again. There was a surprising study, psychological study, that said to the degree to which people are ironic is the degree to which they can be compassionate. And I like it, because it's surprising, because you go, irony, British, bitter, put down thing. No. To be ironic, we must be holding at least two stories at once. What is and what should be. And what is and what people are pretending it is, right? And the change dynamic of tension is in between. And to be compassionate is to cultivate holding more and more stories. What I've been seeing in your work is that you are a great advocate for nuance and complexity and many stories, right? And that
I'm in that right now, because
what.
I'm in that process of holding nuance and complexity in many stories. I think I grew up very liberal. I remain very liberal. And I believe that my politics and my values represent and help put us on a path to something that's better for everyone. And I think given where the U.S. is right now, those with, you know, the other side of the aisle, if you will, the Republican Party, more formally speaking, have opted out of this shared project, and so are deserving of an intense amount of scrutiny and even derision for bailing on the project that we're trying to do together, which is live together with all of our difference. At the end of the day, that's a big premise of what we're trying to do in the United States, and struggling to pull off. And so the progressive liberal me is like, you know, comes up with simple language. Wrong, crazy, deluded, sociopathic, evil, but wrong, and even monstrous. And how could they? And what I've been having an opportunity to practice is to remember that there's no genetic distinction, you know, between Americans and other nations of the world. Like, we're not genetically deserving of any better outcomes than people from Argentina or the Congo. We're not genetically programmed to handle people power better than any other people who have ever had power. But even within our country, there's no distinction between someone who is labeled in certain contexts a Republican or a Democrat or who voted for this person or not. We are all capable of everything. We are all capable of everything. We can all be very compassionate. We're all capable of patience. We're all capable of genocide or looking the other way in the face of it. Here is you and I talk on National Holocaust Remembrance Day. Nations can go that way. And it's not just a handful of evil people. Millions of people can co-sign it passively and can find a way to justify it because their own security and identity are tied up in it. So when I find myself approaching dehumanizing language, especially when I feel it's super justified, I have to check myself because I am capable of that too. And you know how I know? Because I do it every time the World Cup comes around. The World Cup comes around and I'm just like, screw you, Iceland. I don't have a bone to pick with Iceland, but this sport contest gives me an excuse to draw an us them line in the sand and wish a pox on their house and victory to mine. And it's all fiction. You know, it's the rules we made up. It's victory and spoils we've made up. It's values we've made up. So, you know, insurrection's real. The loss of democracy is real. Making it hard for people to vote is real. Not taking a pandemic seriously is real. And those consequences are felt. Also, the people who are aligned with accelerating those things are not that different from us. And I just think it's important to hold those two stories at the same time. Dehumanize those who we accuse of dehumanizing.
Well, it's extremely challenging, right? Because
it's super hard. It's super
creepitudinous
hard.
Corruption is conniption fit inducing. Like, no, don't think.
Creepitudinous corruption. Thank you for that powerful alliterative.
It is. I want to keep the word delusional, though, because it has great meaning. It means de ludo, out of the game. Illusion means in the game. So dreaming. Dreaming keeps us in the game. But delusional is you've lost the common collaborative thread. You're out of the cooperative game.
Yeah.
So I want to toss it back to you because once, you know, in any relationship, once there's contempt or condescension, condescension means we all go down together. And this is where we critique, you know, our team and our not team and everything. Because there's condescension into the cauldron, I think, because there's a lot of kind of, well, if you knew what I knew. And I go, condescension means we all go down together. But, you know, how do you metabolize contempt? It's challenging.
I mean, there's another C. Which is compassion.
Yeah.
And if I've had enough bad days in my life to know that I don't always show up the way I want to. I don't always project what I see of myself inside. And when I don't, sometimes it's because something terrible has happened or something inconvenient just happened to shift my mood in a way. And I've got an excuse for my behavior. Nobody else knows it, but I know it. And if I'm at my wit's end, if I'm at the end of a straw, and then I show up in some bad way and make somebody else's life hard, they don't know any of that. They just see somebody acting the fool. They see somebody being rude. They see somebody being selfish. And they don't know that I'm grieving. They don't know that I've just lost something. They don't know that I'm exhausted and been on the third shift or whatever. So the practice out of contempt into compassion is an internal role-playing opportunity to create an illusion, right? To imagine the other person as you. What could they be going through that explains how they've shown up in this moment?
Right.
Did they just lose a job? Did they just have their kid, you know, puke all over them? And it just helps lower my own temperature. It's not even so much about whether they deserve it or not. It's like, how do I want to feel? Because feeling wound up and bitter and on edge and angry, I am certain that shortens my life. So I don't want to feel those things. Yeah.
It's actually been medically proven to shorten life. Yes. So, but it's like from mythology and politics and everything. When you meet demons in the underworld, you always ask them, "What's your story? And how did this happen to you?"
That's great.
What's your story is really good. I had a great time. Yeah. I mean, I crossed borders. You know, not in this huge way as you do, but I've been to CPAC twice. You know, I went to the Republican convention with the Pacifica team, right?
Yeah.
And I really liked, "What's your story? Tell me about that."
That's a good one.
And seeing
how
to spiral out of, I'm sorry, say what?
I'm saying that's a good shorthand. And so I thank you. One of mine is like, "What are you afraid of?" Which I learned from someone we had on our podcast. I did this podcast, How to Citizen, which integrates most of the stuff we're talking about here. So we had a man on named Eric Liu from Citizen University, and he advised, ask people what they're afraid of. Like, what do you think is going to happen? What are you worried about losing? And push them to be specific. And you can learn a lot, and they may learn something too, which is they might not have thought about it in that way. And it may lower their own anxiety to realize
that
they're not as afraid, or that they can finally name it and get it out of their system and out of their body in some way. But back to you with the, what's your story? That's just another good way in.
Yeah, what's your story? Everything, you know, is useful, but it is interesting to start with the frame, "What are you afraid of?" Which, even when you say that, there's a little, right? And it is the model that, you know, when we feel safe, which is, again, what we would want for all beings, our blood pumps to all of our organs and we feel safer. And when we feel not safe, you know, it constricts the heart and there's less blood flow to the organs, which makes us feel scareder.
Yeah.
So it's a catch 22. It's like, that's why in parts of the show we go, and that's where magic mushrooms and entheogens step in and go, "Here, humans, feel safe for a minute and start from there."
Yes. That's great. I was going to say aliens, but I love the plant medicine. That's great.
They are aliens. The mushrooms come from outer space and we need their help. It's a kinship sacrament that's, you know, part of democracy. Really, but even just the idea of it, so I mean, and also you worked at the Onion. I love that. And did you read Mad Mag? No, you're too young to read Mad Magazine when you were little, right?
I was familiar with Mad Magazine, and I had a few, but I don't have detailed memories of what was inside the pages. No.
Well, it's so wonderful. I mean, these little imprints and the humor,
yeah,
dark humor,
yeah.
so wonderful. But I just remember because my older siblings had the thing, and it was just highway signs along the way. You know, "Can't afford to wait much longer. Fat Nikita getting stronger. Sherman tanks." Anyway, it was just you know, mocking everything.
Yeah.
You know, in a liberating.
It is freeing. I came up, one of my college friends who pushed me to write my first book, a little thin self-published like 90-page thing called Better Than Crying, which was a collection of my satirical essays and one-liners and things. He said, "You mock the world. You need to write a book where you just mock the world." And I always appreciate it. His name is Maui Azgadam. He helped put me on some of the path that I'm on. My early comedic influences, Mad Magazine wasn't one of them. But British comedies on public television were, because my mother watched a lot of Are You Being Served, One Foot in the Grave, Chef, these shows where language was a weapon and where the wit was so fast. We listened to a lot of comedy of Whoopi Goldberg and Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy and some Red Fox. On LP and on cassette and occasionally on VHS. And then we listened to audio stories and plays on the local public radio station, Lum and Abner and The Lone Ranger, which wasn't so much comedic, but Lum and Abner was hilarious to me as a kid. So there was all of this kind of really old school input coming in. Eddie Murphy wasn't old school. He was very young and contemporary for the time, but a lot of multiple types of influences coming in, and a little bit of comic books, a little bit of Calvin and Hobbes, Asterisk Ooh. And Obelisk, the Gaul series. And so I had those sorts of, not so much Marvel, superhero stuff, different types of stories that had a lot of comedy in them. And I think I picked up a bunch of these pieces along the way before I was able to start shaping my own.
Well, your TED Talk, which is great, and I watched it. My cat watched it as he was dying, and he was like, "That's great, goodbye." So we did. But I loved your homage to your English teacher, to language. You just referenced it to the diagramming sentences, and I know you don't have PowerPoint or your disembowered PowerPoint because you're finding Zoom more intimate, which is great. But can we just do a little bit, just for the fun of it? Because you speak of diagramming sentences, subject, action, target, activity, and then you get to play with those. I don't know if
you in 2019 I did a TED Talk called "How to Deconstruct Racism One Headline at a Time." Which I got to give credit to my wife, Elizabeth. She came up with that title, or at least 90% of it. And it describes what I do in the talk, which is I take news headlines of white people calling the cops on black people in various circumstances, a phenomenon that really flooded a lot of our feeds for a window of time in Oakland. You know, right there is one of the early stages of it. That was Barbecue Becky. You know, right at the lake there, like Merritt calling the cops on this group of black people barbecuing, you know, in public, which is perfectly fine to do. But there were a lot of other examples of this, and they represented a weaponization, you know, of white discomfort. To say, like, I'm not comfortable with this black presence in this space. They don't belong there. And I'm not going to confront. I'm not going to interrogate or ask. I'm going to act in this way. I'm going to call in the power of the state. And so I lined up all these headlines and sort of felt the pattern in them, just in my own process. And in the talk, I lay it out more elegantly than happened in real life, where you end up with the same thing happening in all of these different circumstances. A subject, generally a white person, takes an action, different part of the sentence, against a target, you know, generally a black person, engage in some activity, like anything in the world. And the action was always calls police. The subject was almost always white. The target was almost always black. But the activity had no correlation to anything. It was random. It was, you know, a bad study. And it was just living, it turns out. That's what it all correlated to. Sitting in a car, opening a door, entering a building, barbecuing at a lake, selling something on the corner, like water, specifically water, not drugs. Yeah. Waiting for a cab, going to work, all this stuff was deemed law-breaking and required this subject to call in extraordinary powers. You know, in the context of how policing plays out in this country, the power of to impose death on someone without, you know, a jury finding and then a judge's ruling. That's wicked, you know, in certain ways, and it's sad, but that same grammar helped me see some of the structure within any type of system of abuse, where it's not just about individuals acting, it's about a type of behavior that a system encourages, incentivizes, or ignores and allows to fester. And so that same structure, a subject takes this action against the target for engaging in some activity, it's not just a racial lens you could use it. You could use it through a gendered lens around, you know, men abusing women in the workplace. And once you understand the pattern, then you have the power to change it. Like, well, what if we flip the order around? You know, what if it's the target that's calling the cops on the subject? Or what if we changed the action and we didn't call the cops at all? Or we didn't sexually harass and make stupid comments or physically, you know, touch people in ways they don't want? What if we listened as the new action? What if we waved as the action? What if we intended good things for as the action?
Then we could
live in a world of very different headlines and reflect something about ourselves back to ourselves that we could be more proud of. And that's a choice we can make. and it can roll up to create a new system that isn't as abusive as the one we're trying to escape. Yeah,
we're going to do more fun with that switching and reversal and expansion and power of stories, and that the systems are just a collection of stories that's so good, are perfect for now, for this dark of the moon where we're determining the course of culture. Is Baratunde Thurston. His website is baratunde.com, and we'll be right back after a brief musical offering from Damien Escobar called Phoenix. So just feel what supports us when everything's collapsing. Here we go. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our more than splendid guest is Baratunde Thurston. And then just briefly, that was Damien Escobar, song Phoenix. And I love it so much because you have the beat and then the yearning, aspiring violin on top. It's like the kinship of grief. And anyway, and I just want to say that to all DJs out there who do the music like doom, doom, doom. It's like, that's the beat. On top of it, the yearning. Anyway, that's what makes community. So we get to play some more Baratunde. And your wonderful level 4 game, again, do watch Baratunde's TED Talk. But it reminds me also of Eddie Izzard's riff. He says, Star Trek, a very advanced civilization, but their phasers only had 2 settings, stun or kill. He said, we need many, many more phaser settings, right? This is kind of like your game. He said, you know, left kettle on at home, setting, you know, sudden interest in moss, setting, I will kill you, oh, look at the thing. And just to toss back to you, the power of energetic blessing as part of your compassionate repertoire, I mean, to the creepitudinous corruption and those who are victims by embodying it. But, you know, our team likes to say, you know, because we are friends of your soul, we are friends of your indictment, because it's not good for anybody to get away with nonsense. I mean, is that a fun way for you to play?
I've not played in that way. I like the sound of it. Also, like weaver of context, you have a way with words yourself. Friends of your indictment and not letting people get away with nonsense.
Right, because it would be bad. It would be bad for their soul. We're friends of your soul. You know. I think that's the antidote to contempt. You know. You know, your goodness, the part of you that was ethical rather than expedient. We're talking to that, and we're wishing you well.
Well,
and
that's
then we're not poisoned.
There's so much there. One, we're all connected in such a way that there really is no other per se. We share air, of course, and we find that out with pollution, with respiratory viruses in a really tangible sense. We share energy, wavelengths, and the physicists can get involved in this conversation and break that down more specifically than I would right now. So, you know, someone else's pain, I feel that, right? Whether I'm aware of it or not, consciously, it does affect me. And so you want people to feel healed and whole, not just out of altruism, but out of selfishness. Because we got to interact with these people too, even if you're just at that level. Like, I don't want you pissed off all day because you're going to ruin my day when we bump into each other at the gas line. So let's not have that happen. But this idea of, I'm interpreting it as a certain kind of holding people to their own highest standard, a certain type of accountability. I'm not going to let you get away with your own BS. Because you don't really want that. There's a part of all of us that wants that, but there's another part that wants to be held higher and wants to see the elevated version of ourselves. So if we could speak to that, we might see more of that. And I think what's really potent about the previous president, who, you know, people looked at, a lot of liberals looked at superficial and say, he's not that smart. He's not that smart. First of all, if he's not, he still has a lot of power, and that can be a deadly combination. But I think, you know, we do ourselves a disservice when we don't measure the types of intelligence this person displays. He is adept and very skilled at speaking to our lesser selves. He can draw that out of people. And he's so effective at it that he commandeered 50% of the political parties in the United States. Just absolute, with no bloodshed, not much, mild amount of bloodshed, mostly rhetoric and manipulation and promises and bullying and cajoling. And he drew terrible things out of people who were always capable, but didn't so fully indulge. People who had declared themselves against everything he stands for. The Lindsey Grahams of the world. Total capitulation without putting a gun to his head. Not one that we could see. And Ted Cruz, you know, assaulted his man's wife and his dead father. And Ted Cruz can't carry enough water for this guy. Still, not even president anymore. So he's very intelligent in some dimension. And he's very, I think, particularly intelligent at the opposite of what you just described, of not befriending the indictment, but agitating it and drawing out something much more ugly in us and wielding that power and then unleashing it among the populace so that our children are feeling it in schools with increased mocking. And folks show up to school board meetings with guns. What? I mean, we haven't seen that sort of thing in American. Well, okay, we have. Hello, Bullcon. Hello, White Citizens Councils. It's the remix, you know? But it's been a while since it was unleashed so broadly in such everyday fashion. But it means we can do something different. We can do the opposite.
Right. And I just, there's so much in what you say. So I just want to, for myself, replace the word intelligent, but just refine it, go cunning.
Yeah.
There's cunning. Very cunning. Because that's intelligence without feeling. That's the sociopathic dynamic. But
it is.
Cunning.
It's sociopathic intelligence, yeah.
It's Gollum, my precious man. And it does create mob mind. And mob mind is the toxic mimic of our community, right? But it's that permission. And I like people who write about it say, you know, even when we say things like, I don't know what got into me. I don't know why I said that. And it's like, mob mind. You know, and to dispel that in a way, and that's why we're meeting here in the dark of the moon, Baratunde, so that public discourse is not primarily reactive, going, oh my God, oh my God. It's like, that sucks, and here's where we're going. Here we got the conversation, and you're included to animate that. You know, we're both dedicated to people who have, you know, accurate critique and then ingenuity. And I loved one of your guests, Shaka, on a podcast who's now a high media tech guy having served in prison. But he said, you know, the ingenuity of the inmates, right? To be able to make a lighter out of a battery and a thing out of a thing. And here you know, and somebody else was talking about that, the ingenuity of those who have nothing. You know, in Africa, you want to charge your phone, here's some apple cider and a copper wire and a bicycle. Here you go. Right. So, to welcome that which has been most undervalued is where the ingenuity and the soul that's necessary, you know, that inclusivity that you're dedicated to, and you animating the story as you do so often, you know, come, we can do this thing.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, you go.
I'm remembering many things hearing you talk about Shaka and Shaka Sengor, renowned author at this point. His new book just came out. I think it's in the other room. I can't cite the title exactly. It's Letters to the Sons of Society. I'm pretty sure that's it. But his first book, Righting My Wrongs. Yeah, Shock is from Detroit. Served 19 years in prison for murder that he definitely committed, and has done his best to atone for that and become an asset rather than a liability to his community. I met him in the context of the MIT Media Lab, which is not a place you expect to meet someone like Shaka. And we were both fellows in this program together, and I learned another perspective on innovation from a man who came from and lived in the ultimate set of constraints. Literal constraints, wrists and sometimes ankle constraints in prison. And his sharing about the level of ingenuity and genius and adaptation and creativity from people who had almost nothing, but made a lot of things happen. And in the world we live in, where we celebrate certain types of creativity, certain types of innovation and ingenuity, but ones where the constraints are much looser and they come with a nice safety net and, you know, parents and full employment and a 401k maybe, and the ability to drop out of college to take a risk on an internet startup that ultimately mines people's behavior and deepest self-interest to sell to the highest bidder. And we call it innovation, and we celebrate and want to replicate that model. And we ignore the other geniuses. We make it possible to ignore them, because we locked them up and you put them out of sight, and that's out of mind. And then I was thinking about all that, and then I was remembering the name of your show, The Visionary Activist. And one of the things I want to do is like activate that part of us that's not the cunning part, that's the loving part, that's the connected part, that activates the part of our society that we have intentionally left dormant or silenced, even like actively muted, so that we can all benefit from it. Because we got a lot of opportunities ahead of us. That's cool. We also have hella challenges. You know, everything's on fire or sinking or drowning or burning or smoke. It's all jacked up with the climate, and that's getting worse. And we need one of those proverbial all hands on deck type situations. But we've been living in this story where we're like, there's not enough to go around, so I gotta hoard this and keep those others away from it, because they might take what's mine, when they could help make something more of yours. They could help make things that you could own more of. So there's an activating a mindset of collective abundance when we think about collaboration and not just competition, and when we broaden our definitions of the words we say we hold dear, words like innovation and genius, or words like freedom, which are pretty incompatible with living in a lie, which is its own form of captivity, but which a lot of people have subscribed to preserve their so-called freedom. Freedom to be ignorant, freedom to dismiss real information, freedom to deny what's true just because it hurts a little bit for a little while. That sounds like you're a slave to a lie, you know? So whether it's, you know, the whole critical race theory thing and being afraid of actual U.S. history as one potent and somewhat loud and recent example.
Right. Well, because also what goes with, you know, what's your story is my friend who just died taught me this years ago, is that people never mind being asked, did you know? Did you know this thing? You know, and I just learned from a wonderful etymologist, Susie Dent, that our word free is related to love and friend. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. Isn't that wonderful? I don't see a gun anywhere in those words, right?
It's so sad.
Love and friend.
To have a concept of freedom that is predicated on defensiveness and loneliness is tremendously sad. I have to defend my freedom from everybody, you know, and you're just gonna point outward at the whole world, so your whole world is just you. You want to fight for that? I mean, okay, but I'm telling you, there, you might feel better if. Then what do you actually want to feel like, dude? It's often a dude. Do you like feeling afraid? Do you like feeling under threat? Do you like feeling suspicious all the time? Do you like feeling like you're on guard at every moment? Because I'm not speaking for you. I'm just saying, like, that sounds exhausting for me. I don't know if I could get up every day prepared for war like that. Oh, wait, I do, because I have kind of lived that. And it's exhausting.
It is.
We share that.
And
we share that.
And
it's exhausting.
It's actually kind of colonized mind. We've done for a long time, you know, with cultures of blessing. The Middle East under all the rubble is a culture of blessing. You know, morning of light to you, and may roses be strewn upon the path of all you love, and it's blessing poker, and even more to you. You know, again, the day is woven together with blessing, even just little bits. You know, anything else, madam, for tea, salam tek, only your peace. Oh, that's just, and that weaving, and I think it's part of your strong dynamic. Let me offer this to you. I mean, do you feel that one of your very positive yang qualities is strong enough to be gentle?
Yeah. I've learned that one backwards. You know, I've always been very gentle. And I'm finding different ways to exercise my strength. It's been there the whole time. Even my mother saw it and named me for it. My name kind of combines to mean kingly companion.
Your name is what?
Kingly companion is
that's
part
what Baratunde means?
No, it's with the combination of Baratunde with Rafik, my Arabic middle name, which means friend. And Baratunde's father returns, and one who is chosen, kind of woven into one. So whether they literally mean that matters so much less than what she intended for them to mean and what she was trying to imprint on me. I'm not an outwardly violent person. Very rarely. I mean, when pushed, we all can be. But that's, I don't lead with that kind of use of force. And I try to exercise the power in a slightly different way. So, yeah, we can be strong and peaceful. And sometimes stronger through peaceful means.
Yeah, and have a lot of credibility. I mean, it's potent people. Well, but people who've been to prison, people who've been to the underworld, people who've gone to and done terrible things and come back.
Yeah.
There's a special kind of trustworthiness in that. You know, and they've done the powerful, scary thing, and so they have that strength and that credibility, and then they choose how to be, you know, but many great people working in prisons and in prisons and out of prisons and the returning citizens in the Bay Area, former lifers are really community guides. They meet every inmate coming out, going, here, lad, here's a cell phone. This is what this works. This is what email is. Here you go. And here's a job. And here's food. And community, real community, coming out of people who've endured hardship, and that's kind of where it comes from, to be strong enough to be gentle, it's got no credibility if it's sort of like, hi, how are you? But it's like, hello. But if it's like strong,
you gotta trust
and
the messenger.
Choosing.
You gotta have, I mean, the best people to talk to someone who's considering gang life is someone who was actually in gang life. Probably not me. You know, I don't have deep credibility in helping somebody make that decision. And the same goes true for any kind of cult, the religious cults. You get ex-cult members, and they help get people back from that. And if there's political cult type stuff, you know, then people on the right ain't going to listen to Rachel Maddow about it. You know, if the ghost of Rush Limbaugh comes back and said, oh, maybe I said some things I shouldn't have, and this seems a little extreme, don't you think? Then that might, you know, they might listen to that. People want to hear from folks that they believe. And that credibility is a big important part of that belief. So, which on that?
Right. Well, and I just want to go back to the genius of in your TED talk of the four things and the rather than call the police, you know, thank this person, rather than call the police on the little girl selling water on the street corner, she bought all of her water. and then distributed it for free. Yeah. Rather than, you say, the executive masturbating in front of the secretary, what if he, instead of doing that, listened to her and started a company in which they all got rich? What if we, I think these are parts of our capacity, and humorous play, what do you want? And even, satire and insult, if they're funny, they do liberate even the subject. I mean, I think it's really true. It's like, ha. It's like there were a convention. Like,
There's to liberate the subject.
Yes,
that's good. I mean, I think that can happen when if you get people to laugh at themselves. And to see a different truth in themselves, then that is a bit of a self-liberation. I'm laughing. I'm acknowledging. I'm agreeing with you. If I'm laughing at something you just said, we have the same point of view for a split second. Yeah.
Well, I just a fun little mini moment at the Republican convention. There was a way too flirty older Baptist minister, Trump delegate. He's like, I go, want to play a game? He's like, I love games. And I said, well, I have quotes from Trump and quotes from ISIS, and you tell me which is which. He goes, okay, we must destroy the world in order to recreate the thing. And he goes, oh, that's Trump. And I go, that's ISIS. And he said, got me.
Yeah.
And he liked it. He liked it. See, I think people really do want to be unlocked, right? And the play, just a woof woof want to play. And they, again, whatever we speak to another person is the part of them we're inviting out. Now, like yourself, there are, Trump, the cunning, the thing, that's hard not to feel contempt for myself. but from the Black spiritual teachings, they say there's no one we couldn't love if we really knew their story. And I think that's good. Curiosity is...
Love is an important, thing to pause on for a minute. Love doesn't mean like. It doesn't mean agree with all the time. It doesn't mean enjoy the company with no matter what. Ask a parent what love means. You don't always like your kid, but you love them. You definitely don't always agree with them. Sometimes they exhaust you. They get you at wit's end, and you love them. And they can be very disappointing. People we love can betray us, and we love them. So there, to get deeper into what love actually is really important. It's something I learned from my very first podcast guest, Valerie Kaur, K-A-U-R, also from the great state of California. And she, talks about revolutionary love in her book, See No Stranger, which has inspired a lot of my thinking on everything we've been talking about. Yeah. Hmm.
And I love, I got to hear a Zoom from Naomi Tutu, Desmond Tutu's daughter, back in November. And it was just deep, calm, and blazing in its complexity, and blazing in its complexity about the Truth and Reconciliation Act and people who'd done just horrible, horrible things and then had these sort of normal lives over there. And she said even when they were offered amnesty on civil and criminal levels, some of them still wouldn't. She goes, why wouldn't they? Because they'd never told themselves the truth, right? And that was hard. And then somebody asked her, like, well, how do you feel about South Africa now? And she said, well, my kids are the same age as South Africa, and sometimes they say the most wonderful things, and I go, how could I have given birth to such geniuses? It's whatever. And sometimes they do the most horrible, 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 delinquent, crazy, cruel, selfish things, and I go, and she goes, that's the age of the country. That, and I go, that's a wonderful nuance, and we're going to love everybody through it.
Yeah.
That's right. So have you been able to put down the invisible burden of other people's fear?
Increasingly, but not universally, not consistently. It's hard.
Well, and that's why the genius systems are collections of stories and changing the stories and in the group mind, known as media, but really group mind, the expanded repertoire of responses, rather than call the police, you could, give somebody a some chocolate. I mean, rather than you could do that. And see, the cult, the con creates cults, right? The toxic mimetic community. Whereas the whole level of the rebirth of democracy in our waning moments here for this particular dance. But so we have the election this year. And you have been on your retreat gathering your wits and kind of like come powers of blessing and eloquence come to and wondering what you want to do and how to be most influential. Do you have any thoughts on the danger? Well, you have many thoughts, but on the danger and the danger of this election and how to stay curious, responsive, and strategic and intelligent rather than rah, 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 rah.
There was a few years back, I had occasion to have a conversation with the head of MSNBC. And I said, I got some ideas for you. You should do these things. They're very good ideas. I'm giving to you for free. And so when you cover this election, this is like we talked in 2014 or 2015. Like, could you not? Like, we don't need to frame things around issues. You know, it's just very inhuman. Issues, gun violence, and it's like a checklist and a matrix and a grid that you're trying to fill out. It's like a test. And let's leave the halls of alleged power, and just have some of this programming. Just talk to people. Talk what they want, what they need, what they're excited about, what they're afraid of. Some version of that. I'm being much more eloquent about it now. But I probably have the email to show that I wanted a bottom-up way of talking about what this election is and what's at stake, and to get out of the like former advisor says kind of conversation about politics. Former elected official says, current elected official says. They're kind of at the end of the line, and I wanted to go upstream a little bit to just talk to people about what they want and what they need and what is important to them, and tell those stories, tell their stories, not the pollster's version of their story. I'd still love to see that. And I think with this upcoming midterm, the agenda that we end up following for national level conversations about an election, most of us don't feel like we choose that. We're just subject to it, you know? And we want to flip that sentence around. And I'd love for, whether it's someone who's running for office or someone who is in the media business, the medium of being in between the people and these halls of power to some degree and representing them through communication, to ask people, how do you want to feel in this country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you need in your life? What would make your life better? And also ask the fear questions, because a lot of us are cutting and pasting talking points that we didn't come up with, but they make us feel like we're being heard. So we just run with it because it's a shortcut. But also no one's asking. So it's hard to blame people for showing up to the only show in town. You know, for reading the only book in the library. let's give them something
What's your story is good, but also what's your definition of good governance? It's like, whoa. But anyway, we're having too much fun. Thank you so much, Bertundi.
Beautiful pleasure. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
I'm super
appreciative. That's really great. So, in cultivating ever-expanding repertoire of liberating responses, that's what we're up to. All right, thank you, Bertundi. Thank you, Kirsten Thomas. Wonderful board up. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Thanks again. Okay.